What a great opportunity to have a panel like this, you know, which Dave's event has made possible. And really, everyone up here has, you know, plowed the soil for, you know, decades in keeping a progressive culture alive in this country. And whether or not the government sort of gives the notion that there is no opposition right now to its policy, I believe that there is a rich subtext everywhere that shows that the result of decades of hard work is frankly present in every decision that is made. You know, the fact that even that Bush, and I concede nothing to Bush, felt obliged to have to come out and make statements against, you know, racial depictions of Arab Americans, for example, is not something that simply came from the Republican Party as an idea. It was because there has been an anti-racist work in this country and a climate that required there to be some addressing of that issue, however short-lived, frankly, and however not followed up, frankly, and however many hundreds of Arab Americans are currently in jail without charges today. But nonetheless, you know, I think the movement has a lot to be to recognize in terms of the power. And Dave sort of always, the title of his second or third book, More Power Than We Know, I think is important to keep in mind when we approach the future and when we, you know, recognize that we're not so marginalized as the media and the government would like us to think that we are. Anyway, let's move on to some discussion of media representations of September 11th. I mean, if Amy would take a seat up here, you can have my chair, certainly. I'm happy to give it up. I'll just one, you know, last Friday, the New York Times reported how George Bush had taken on the gravitas of a great statesman through his conduct in the leadership of the president of the war effort. And they also made a point talking about how much more articulate he had become in addressing these issues. In the same day's paper, I looked back to the transcript of the press conference, which was cited as evidence of his newfound articulation ability. And I just put my finger down like that, and I came up with a quote, just for a little levity, and I hate to... Here's the direct quote, word for word. "It's not the kind of war that we're used to in America. The greatest generation was used to storming beachheads. Baby boomers such as myself was used to getting caught in a quagmire of Vietnam where politics made decisions more than the military sometimes. Generation X was able to watch technology right in front of their TV screens, you know, burrow into concrete bunkers in Iraq." So I said, you know, on the lead article that day in the New York Times was congratulating Bush on his, you know, laser focus. Anyway, I hate to make fun, but I just want to open this up.
Of course. You hate to make
fun. I want
to
open this up, and we haven't heard from Gwenda yet, and I'd like us to maybe finish the last five. If we went 5 or 10 minutes over, I don't know if that's a bad thing, but I'd like us to if we could. But to focus on the question of media workers as we sort of face the future. I mean, several of us are, but Gwenda is, Amy is in particular, Jeff is working in media. Just some of, you know, what it's like and where we go and, you know, what the opportunities are. One of the things that's happened in the result of September 11th, frankly, is that some media workers, like Len's friend at the New York, is it Post or Daily News? Post have frankly lost their jobs because they commented critically in some way, shape, or form. So there may be some discussion here about media and about just how much room or lack of space has been provided for alternate views to represent themselves. Also, I think something we have today that we didn't have as much in the Vietnam War era is some alternate press, a stronger alternate press, thanks to the work of people like Amy, you know, to really create strong, you know, whether it's The Onion or, although there have been struggles at BAI and other places, and just how that functions. So I'm going to turn it over, and I don't know who wants to chime in with the first. Gwenda? 12:15 is fine, I'm told. Go ahead.
I just wanted to pick up for a minute or two on what Jeff was saying and Lenny. I understand the strategic considerations for choosing Elizabeth Colbert. I'm sorry they didn't choose me, because it sounds to me like she blew the lead, for sure. But I work in mainstream commercial media, and being able to hang on to the story, there's a lot of pressures not to. I was spoiled. I told Jay last night, I feel like I was spoiled by first getting involved in the media by working with Dave at Liberation and then at 7 Days. He set a very high standard for telling the story, and nothing has ever measured up to that since. I've just had to go ahead and work in other places. But the two books that Jay mentioned, one about Jessica Savage, who was a TV anchor, and the other one about the Trump family, were efforts, among other things, in a way to find a way to tell the story. The story about Jessica Savage really isn't so much about Jessica Savage, but it's about the rise of broadcast news as a vehicle to sell advertising and how that worked. And going from radio into television, how it became an image-driven media instead of a word-driven media, instead of an idea-driven media, and what the impact of that was. Jessica Savage's contribution, as I said to Howard Zinn last night, was that she was one of the first to get that in television news, what mattered was how you looked. The facts didn't matter. Getting another fact into her report mattered a lot less than practicing her camera angles. And she was right. That is how television works. It is image-driven. And at the end of a broadcast, you have a feeling that you learned something, but in fact, it's very hard to hang on to any piece of information because it's not presented in a narrative or sequential line. And in the book that I did about the Trumps, and I should say, there was a lot of pressure on me in that book to have less about the growth of television news, more about the often sad details of Jessica Savage's life. And being able to hold on to what the real story is, which was Lenny was saying, and not to fall into the sort of stereotypical thing or the celebrity part of it, is not easy. Doing a book about Donald Trump, speaking of celebrities, being able to hold on to the story to me wasn't how mendacious he is, what an egomaniac he is, but rather how representative he is of how capitalism worked. And the way I ended up doing it was about him, his father, and his grandfather as kind of case studies in a way. And it was really what he fit into. That was what was interesting to me, not so much him. And the amount of pressure, again, to just vilify him. Of course he's horrible. Of course he's an egomaniac. Of course he's dreadful. But then what? How come he harnessed all of that and made it work? That's what's important. And I think that this New Yorker piece that you're talking about, the rehabilitative things that took place, that's what's important. That is the story. And the rest is like what you got to get through to get to that. And I don't know the pressures that were on Elizabeth Colbert. Let's assume she did her best. But that she missed it, or the New Yorker missed it. Maybe we should put it that way. Maybe that's more fair. And now I think we should talk about September 11th, because I think the same things are in front of us. Once again, the story isn't Osama bin Laden. You know, that's what everything's being funneled into that, and the pressures to resist that are it's very hard to resist that. It's very hard to hold on to some kind of sort of talking points and hold your head in the middle, especially in New York City. The blizzard of flags everywhere I go, it's very hard to do that.
Okay, so good. It's a good start. Amy, do you want to say something?
Well, on September 11th, when the two planes, the hijacked planes, rammed into the World Trade Center towers and knocked them both down, killing more than 5,000 people, the exact numbers we'll never know, we were broadcasting in exile from WBAI in Pacifica in a firehouse just blocks from there. Ironically, a firehouse where at the end of each broadcast I had been saying what better place to be in the midst of a firestorm, but that had to do with Pacifica and the kind of corporate pressures and establishment pressures are bringing this crisis to a head of independent media. And then we had this happen. We stayed in the firehouse for the next few days because we were in the midst of the evacuation zone, and we knew that the police and the federal authorities were going to evacuate us if we dared get caught by them or outside in the dragnet that was taking place as all the emergency workers were coming in. But it, you know, is the face of evil, what we saw. We saw in that one moment thousands of innocent people murdered, killed. And I think this is something that people have seen around the world. One night I was walking outside after September 11th in that area, and it continues to be just the whole thing so horrendous. Just coming into the area now, as I've gone outside of the evacuation zone, just coming to Chinatown where we're working, the smell is heavy in the air. That smell is the smell of burning material, like burning tires. They say there is asbestos and fiberglass in the air, bone dust. And we are reminded of this every single day, as Lori Garrett, a reporter at Newsday, you know, said that this is a funeral pyre that's all of southern Manhattan now, and the evacuation workers are still there. And I think of people like James Creedon, who's a 911 paramedic who we had on the program, who spoke at an anti-war rally a week later, 24 years old. And he's been, first he survived because he went down there, and after the first crashing down of the tower, he and others almost didn't make it. Many firefighters and police who were truly what they call the finest, and this is what we have to remember about what police and firefighters are supposed to be doing, not shooting young immigrants 41 times, but saving people or trying to save people's lives. And I think we saw so much of that heroism at the World Trade Center and continue with to see with the dedication of these emergency workers. But James Creedon going down there, getting hurt himself, continuing to work, but then as he is working there, realizing that in Washington, they weren't part of the mourning process or the trying to save process that was taking place in New York. They were preparing to kill other people. And knowing that as he was digging in the debris, and he said he had to speak out. And in fact, a lot of paramedics, he said, felt as he felt, that as they are digging in the debris of the World Trade Center, that they don't want paramedics in Kabul, Afghanistan, to be doing the same thing. And it's not only James we heard that from. It's a common refrain now all over New York, not in my name. Like Rita Lazar says, not in my brother's name. Her brother Abe died on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. He refused to leave his best friend Ed, who is a paraplegic, and he was hoping the firefighters would come up. He easily could have left. And that story is also amazing, that you know more than 90% of the people did survive. 50,000 people working there, 150,000 in any day going through the World Trade Center. But Abe would not leave, and his brother was screaming on the phone to him, get out of there now. He could have easily made it. People on the 100th floor made it. He said he wouldn't leave Ed. And so they went down together. And Rita, who is the mother of Matthew Lazar, who wrote the history of Pacifica, you know, this network that was founded by a man who refused to fight in World War II, was a pacifist, and said there has to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations but run by journalists and artists. Not, as George Gerbner says, at University of Pennsylvania, corporations with nothing to tell and everything to sell. So that's how Pacifica was born. Matthew's mother, Matthew's uncle, Abe, died in the World Trade Center attacks. And then there's Orlando and Phyllis Rodriguez, whose son Greg worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. He had worked at CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity of the People of El Salvador, but was above the 100th floor. And they wrote a letter. Rita's letter did get published in the New York Times. Orlando and Phyllis's letter about their son Greg, also not in our son's name. Don't start beating the drums of war for what happened to our son. And yet we see on television the celebration of bloodlust that is not reflected on the streets of New York by the people who are right at ground zero, who have suffered the worst. And that's because they've known pain, and they don't want that in pain inflicted on other people. Now, we do see in the media the stories of the people who lost loved ones in the World Trade Center. And we should see them. We can't see them enough, because this terror must be eradicated all over the world. But you don't see the continuation of the discussion. Now, this is what happened. This is Greg. This is Abe. Tell us what you think should happen now, because those people are very willing to speak. Judy Kane in Weatherfield, Connecticut, lost her husband in the World Trade Center attacks. He was a Marine. He fought in Vietnam. 5,000 people came out to the vigil a couple days after the center because her husband and two others in Connecticut were lost at the World Trade Center. 5,000 people. And Judy's saying, no, we don't want to kill innocent civilians like my husband was killed. But their stories, while you will see them written up, you don't see the second part. What do they suggest as the solution? For that, the media, especially the broadcast media, goes to the, quote, terrorism experts like Henry Kissinger, like Oliver North. Now, if in the sense it takes one to know one, they are terrorism experts, right? I mean, if... But why don't you hear the people right there talking about what they believe should take place? The media keeps repeating the polls. More than 90% of Americans want us to go to war. Now, I don't believe that. From talking to hundreds of people now, just in New York alone, not to mention people all over the world since then, I don't believe, or I should say, I would like to see what the question is that people are being asked. Because if you say, do you believe that the killing of innocent civilians should be answered by the killing of innocent civilians somewhere else? I think that that same 90%, even higher, would say no, that we should not avenge the killing of innocent civilians by killing other innocent civilians. And in this case, it's Afghanistan, people who have been terribly victimized. I mean, you look at the women, and RAWA is very clear about this. That's the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And by the way, you're seeing them a little more in the news now. You know, you have a dark image of them because they cannot be seen even in the burqa. They are terrified of what will happen to their family members. This is a revolutionary group. They are very radical. They have come out of Afghanistan. They're women who are in Pakistan. They've been fighting the Taliban. They fought the Mujahideen. They've been fighting the Northern Alliance. And they are not for war. And they say that these networks of people have been terrorizing us for years, supported by the United States. And of course, there's the whole story of Osama bin Laden, the Saudi millionaire, father, a Yemeni construction magnate, who ended up going to Afghanistan, trained by the CIA, funded by the CIA, along with a number of others who were fighting the Soviet Union, and now it's blowback time. Now they set their sights back on the United States. You don't hear that story as many times as we have heard Osama bin Laden's name in the media. What about telling his story of how he came to be? And these women, the RAWA women, say no. Even though they have faced absolute terror in their homeland, they're not for the bombing of Afghanistan because they know that the people who will die are innocent civilians like themselves. And this is the terrible lie that's being perpetrated in the media. This is, Chomsky says, and so many others, the media is there to manufacture consent. And you see that in no other time more than in times of war, to manufacture consent for war. And so you see the retired generals brought out on the networks who are on the payroll. They can get the Pentagon's point of view for free, but they actually pay them so they can be there 24 hours a day so we can hear at what point we should move from air war to ground war. That's the range of debate. And now, by the way, as you know, this weekend we have moved into a ground war. And these are very serious issues. I understand that the first day on September 11th, one of the anchors on one of the networks, interestingly enough, though we were so close to ground zero, we were cut off that day from the media because our cable went out. And so we were only experiencing firsthand what was taking place. We actually, and usually it's the opposite for me, I'm watching and absorbing it all the time, what the rest of the media was saying, but we were cut off for days. And I heard that an anchor said, right off the top, when the towers went down, talking about the collateral damage at the World Trade Center, it's something like thousands of people down. Collateral damage. How could you refer to thousands of people as collateral damage? Well, we do it all over the world, but not here. And that was the end of that. He never, ever said that again. Now, of course, that's not collateral damage. That's thousands of individual lives lost, affecting millions of people. It's just close firsthand, all those who lost loved ones and knew people who did. That's not collateral damage, but that's how we refer to others in other parts of the world when they die. I was walking one night. It was raining. The terrible smell was in the air. There was only emergency workers around. There was one deli open a couple blocks away, and everyone was walking in covered with ash, and you could only get, we were getting just cans of food. You don't want anything open there in that area. And truly, it was like a war. And I do call it every day on the show, broadcasting from, well, ground zero. But now it's the first ground zero, because the second now is Afghanistan. But walking in the rain and looking at all of those hundreds of pictures that people put up of color photographs, Xeroxes of their loved ones. You know, Gregory last seen on the 104th floor of the South Tower of the World Trade Center. If you have any information, if you saw him, could you call? And here the papers were getting wet. They're all over New York, thousands of them. And I was thinking of the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina holding the pictures of their sons and their daughters. And, of course, in Guatemala and in East Timor and in all of the Chile. In fact, September 11th was the day Salvador Allende died. And I went to Olympia, Washington last week, and a man from Ecuador came up and told me that. That hadn't even registered. His brother is an Ecuadorian journalist who was killed by authorities there. And he said, did you ever think about that? Well, we have certainly talked about Henry Kissinger and what should happen with him. And if you're talking about terror and being responsible for civilian deaths. And right at that time, it was the 25th anniversary of the killing of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt in the United States, another terror act. But these are the lessons that we have to learn now, but not just lessons, because we have to take this on head on and deal with it. This kind of terror is taking place all over the world. We have seen the ugly face of terror in the United States, and we have to hope that that unites us all against it. And of course, in terms of Osama bin Laden or whoever committed this terrible act, they should be brought to justice. And when we see something like this happen, and these are the kinds of things we keep bringing up, with Timothy McVeigh, when he bombed the World Trade, when he bombed the federal building, he was caught and he was tried. And I don't agree with the death penalty, but he was executed. We never said his sister should be killed, or that his father should be dragged out, or that the upstate New York should be bombed, because that's where he comes from. And that's what we're trying to talk about now. What is justice in this case? For the, how do you deal with these terrible crimes that have taken place? Just some of the images. And now, what are the images we're not getting in Afghanistan? You may have heard about Iconos satellite photography. This is the kind of commercial photography. The satellite is actually owned, I believe, by McDonnell Douglas. Space Imaging is the corporation. It's owned by a military corporation, but they put out the images of what's happening in Afghanistan. And you know how they talk about the satellites being able to see a license plate, that they're that exact? Well, they can see the dead people in Afghanistan now, the civilians strewn on the landscape. But why aren't we not seeing this? Because this is war. This is an ugly time, and we should recognize that we have to be able to assess and critically discuss all of these issues. Because last week, the Pentagon bought up all of the images and bought the exclusive rights, paid a tremendous amount of money, precisely so that we cannot see these images. And just as we should see everything at the World Trade Center, we should be able to see what's happening in Afghanistan so people can make decisions. The largest number of casualties in any war are innocent civilians. And do we want this to happen? And yet we're talking about the huge humanitarian airdrop that we are engaged in. Bush is talking about this in Afghanistan. No, he's not talking about the bombs, though the bombs are falling. Talking about the 35,000 biscuits that they're dropping on the people of Afghanistan. Now, they are facing one of the largest humanitarian catastrophes. Forget the war in Afghanistan in this last period of decades, 5 million people possibly starving. You didn't even need this for that to happen. The aid workers were feeding 5 million people, all the different international aid organizations in Afghanistan. They were forced to flee, almost all of them. So they couldn't feed the people there. And now, instead of 5 million people being fed, we're down to 35,000 ready-to-eat meals that are being dropped, and they're getting a lot of attention. The aid organizations now in Pakistan, who are horrified at this, like Oxfam and UN organizations, are saying this is endangering the people more than helping them. First of all, we can't feed millions of people. But second of all, you're talking about one of the most mined places on earth, Afghanistan. And if kids go out to get those biscuits, they can blow up. If the biscuits fall on a mine, it will blow up, not to mention adults going out to get this food. It is an extremely dangerous situation. It is not helping the people. And then you have Bush say to the children of the United States, send us your dollars. We'll send them to the children of Afghanistan. And they got tens of thousands of dollars from the kids of the United States sent to the White House, and they say they're going to give them to the Red Cross. Meanwhile, on the day that they're announcing this, the U.S. drops 1,000-pound bombs are on the Red Cross warehouses in Afghanistan. Very clear-cut. They have the Red Cross symbols on the roofs, and they deliberately did it. But they say, well, they didn't know who they were being used by. We have to continually break the sound barrier. We have to support the alternative media in doing that, and we have to force the mainstream media, because they don't own the airwaves, they are leasing them, these corporations, to bring us the truth. And I still have hope that that can take place. And finally, I just wanted to say, I understand that here, not only is WGDR running the two-hour War and Peace report we're doing, and I really thank WGDR and applaud them, the Goddard station, but public access television here in Burlington is running our two-hour report. We're doing the largest collaboration of public media in this country. We're broadcasting on Free Speech TV, which is on the Dish Network, every single day, 2 hours. We're broadcasting on community radio stations around the country, despite being banned by our own Pacifica network. But our first Pacifica station, KPFA, is running this. And we're broadcasting on the internet at WBIX.org and webactive.com. So what we're trying to say, especially in this time of war, when it brings out all the reasons why we need independent media, is we must preserve the public spaces that get out information. That's public access TV, and CCTV, is that what it's called here, is doing it every night at 11:45 on Channel 17, and they're doing it all over the country now. Public access television, the internet, we have to use it before we lose it, because it is an incredible way to do grassroots globalizing work as we fight the corporate globalizing that's going on. And we must preserve community radio in this country, which is why we have to fight for Pacifica Radio in its truest, with its original mission that Lou Hill set out more than 50 years ago. And it's a very important struggle for people to be involved with. And you can get information on that on the web at PacificaCampaign.org and SavePacifica.net. But we must fight for independent media and continue to be, because this is what the media should be all over the country, and that is the exception to the rulers.
That was beautiful, Amy, and thank you for showing us what the direction is that we should all be going and thinking right now. Very much appreciated. So probably we should all just stop talking, but I just want to say, violate my own rule and say that I was watching where my office, all we could get was NBC. And so we watched the morning go down with Tom Brokaw. And before the buildings, after the second plane hit, but before the buildings had fallen, he declared war. He said, "We are at war, and we are going to have to give up a lot of the rights that we've taken for granted." This was before the buildings fell. Brokaw had already declared war and given up our civil rights. And it was appalling. And I'll just add one little piece, which is from the environmental window where I watch some of this going on. One of the first things we saw was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission pull down its website so that you can no longer find out basic information about nuclear power plants in this country. And there's also been a tremendous cutback in right-to-know information that environmentalists have fought for over the years, locations of hazardous polluting facilities all over this country, which were fought for under provisions of the Clean Air Act, have been coming down faster than you can imagine. And there is a concerted right-wing effort to attack groups like OMB Watch in Washington, who have been part of the fight to get that information out there, saying, well, it's more important that we prevent the terrorists from finding out where these chemical manufacturing plants are than that the people who live in these neighborhoods have access to the information about what's polluting polluting their communities.
Well, so one more thing is just to be aware with the whole anthrax scare and the people who have come down, tested positive for anthrax. I want to point out one thing. I have a close friend who works at NBC. And so when this all happened at NBC, when Brokaw got the letter, or his assistant got the letter, and she got sick, the first people they tested were the executives, you know, on the third floor. They were the first, no matter how far away. It wasn't the matter of closeness of proximity to the letter, which, of course, should have been the way you decide on tests. It was, right, how high up you are in the CBS hierarchy. You didn't have to be there. You might have been on vacation. You will get tested. But her very, very serious concern for those who weren't being tested, because then the producers get tested. It's a microcosm of the way society works. You know, the highest paid people getting tested, and it goes right down the rung. But the people who weren't getting tested, the people in the mailroom, obviously the first who should be tested, and the janitors. Those are the first two, because they're all over. They're cleaning up. They're dealing exactly in the places. And just on Friday, we interviewed the head of the Postal Workers Union in New York. As all of these people inside are being tested, the postal workers, the people who work at Trenton, only now getting some attention at the Rockefeller Post Office, Rockefeller Plaza Post Office of CBS, where they know these letters came through. They had nothing to protect them. And then they were told that only people who touched the letter at NBC, when all the mail workers met with the management of the post office, only people who touched the letter at NBC, don't worry, only they're being tested. And so one mail letter carrier said, wait a second, 500 people, because they got that number, hundreds of people have been tested at NBC, did not touch this one letter. We might all, you know, who knows of us, but they did not. It's not true what you're telling us. And the same way that workers aren't protected in all other situations, these postal workers are facing the same thing. It was only when they threatened to go to the media and held a press conference, they were being held back every step of the way, that they started even to give them rubber gloves or respirators. And you're talking about people who are dealing with millions of letters every day. And we have to be very aware of this, not to feed into the hype, but know who, and there is a very serious issue here, who is most vulnerable? And those people have to be protected, and people have to speak up for them and seek them out, because they are willing to speak, and they're very, very afraid.
Dennis Brutus has joined us recently on the panel. Dennis is an anti-apartheid activist, South African poet, and has taught at the University of Pittsburgh and was here this weekend as well. Dennis, do you have any comments?
Sure. Just a couple by way of additions, coming from another angle, perhaps. I was in Durban in South Africa, where some of you know there was a huge global debate going on at what was called the UN World Conference on Racism. I stayed on after that, and in fact was able to watch on South African television the second attack, the first tower already in fire, in flames, and then the plane striking the second one. And I'm sure all this has been covered extensively so far. So I'm going to mention just two points that you may not be aware of. One is that since I've returned to the States, I've spoken perhaps on about 10 different occasions at campuses, churches, etc. And everywhere, what seems to me most impressive is the way people are already getting together, organizing rallies, meetings, candlelight vigils outside churches. And there's the strong demand that no to war. Let's look at why it happened and see what's gone wrong instead of the simplistic response, let's bomb the terrorists. And it seems to me the short comment one should make is that the answer to terrorism is not more terrorism. That all it generates is a spiral of violence, of more bitter and angry people out there in the world who are victims and then who will try desperately to respond to their own suffering. So I think all over the United States, but also in South Africa, and I'll return to that in a moment, there is this encouraging surge of people saying that they're opposed to military action. And it seems to me this is not being adequately covered in the media at all. And one clear need we have is the kind of independent media which we were able to set up groups of people who call themselves indie media. We had it in Seattle, we had it in Prague, we had it in Genoa, we had it in Quebec City, and we had it in Durban. And so all these alternative sources of information that we need to expand in order to counter the kind of almost a mob war hysteria in some cases being whipped up by the mainstream. While I was in Durban, immediately after September 11, there's a live TV talk show. And interestingly, one of the papers that day, the Mail and Guardian, one of the more independent papers, had run a piece on the violence, on what had happened, and saying that surely some of the causes had to be found in the U.S. bombings in other parts of the world. Attacks in the Sudan, in Kenya, in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, that in fact this was not the first, it just happened to be the major event. And that evening they brought on camera, TV, in the studio in Durban, a spokeswoman from the U.S. Embassy. And the reporter, and I'm quite sure he got into trouble afterwards, began by asking her, "Do you agree that this was a long time coming?" And of course she was horrified and reacted very angrily and said, "How dare you say this?" But he was instantly making the point that for many people the perception of the United States as itself a rogue state, a state which defies the resolutions taken in the UN, except when it's convenient for the United States to accept them. All that is into play now, and had in fact been in Durban, and I'll just finish with this, had been in Durban during the World Conference on Racism. Because there, as I'm sure you know, the United States attempted to dictate what the agenda ought to be. That there ought to be no discussion of slavery, no discussion of racism, no discussion of the rights of the Palestinian people. And the United States and Israel both said, if these items are on the agenda, we will walk out of this conference. And the rest of the world said, too bad. we're going to go ahead and we're going to discuss these issues in spite of your demand that the issue should be kept off the agenda. And I think the end of all that was very instructive, that we saw there very clearly that the capacity of the United States to dictate what should be on the agenda and what should not be ended right there. The conference went ahead, the U.S. and Israel walked out, but we demonstrated that the world had changed even then, that the ability of a superpower to dictate simply wasn't going to work on this occasion. So I'd like to leave it there at this point. There are a couple of other issues, but perhaps you should leave those for now.
We have pretty much agreed to end this in about 4 minutes, so I want to just ask the panelists if any of them would like to offer further comments. To start, Dave, Howard, Lenny? Yes, and Gwenda. Yes, I was just thinking people hadn't spoken in the September 11th discussion at all, but of course Gwenda sort of started us off, which I thought was great, but yes, Gwenda. If you have anything further to say as well.
I'll just say this. I've been talking about September 11th since September 10th. I feel as Dennis and a number of other people have expressed, and as Amy said, this 90% figure doesn't make any sense to anybody who has been talking to people around the country. And I don't just talk to radicals, and I don't just talk to groups like this, whoever you are. and I have a definite feeling that even where people start off with a kind of automatic repetition of what they hear on television from the president, it takes just a few questions and a few statements of fact to make people, have second thoughts. And because, as you say, if you ask people, do you really think that this is going to stop terrorism, bombing these people? Do you think it's good to respond to this by killing? No, I mean, it's so clear. So, I think, the future is on our side. I think, the administration has reached the peak of its support, and it's going to go down, down, down from now on. And I'll just say one more thing in response to what you said about what happened at Durban, about the great powers and the power of the superpower. I believe, this sounds like a very portentous statement, but I love to make portentous statements. No. I believe that September 11th is the beginning of the end of the American Empire. Okay.
Yeah. I agree with Howard's closing remarks, and I think that for the first time in most of our lives, that we have the chance of getting rid of militarism and the American Empire, and everybody is beginning to believe in a life of sharing and forgiveness and beginning in our own lives.
I hope out of this and out of other meetings, there's some strategic agreements that we're going to come up with. I think talking about going back to the Kathy Houdin story and feeling like she missed the lead, I think the lead story in the New York Times should be 5 to 6 million people are going to starve. That's the most unambiguous piece of information. Everything else is enormously important. That's the most unambiguous piece and the one that people can most readily, immediately see. Why is that buried? I found it in the New York Times, but only by looking. Only by looking really hard. And I think that's the sort of the piece that's being that should be in the front that's now in the back. And that's our job to make it be in the front, which BAI is doing.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a thrilling opportunity for me, certainly, to be here and hear these, you know, extraordinary and divergent takes on issues that are important to all of us. I want to thank the Film Festival for making it possible.